Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we discuss one of the greatest albums of all time.
And no, folks, we really mean it this time. This is serious. It is not Kiss.
No!
All right, Patrick, it's been a whole day since we've done a patron episode. I think we should do another one today.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, I feel like it.
Yeah, this is good. We love hearing from the listeners. We love the support, and we love the topics that they bring to us because, you know, maybe something we wouldn't have thought of. Practically all the time, it's things we would have thought of, right?
I think that's right, too. And also the fact that we learn so much.
That's
You know, it's like a little mini history lesson for us, and it's great. We get to get, like, free adult education without having to pay for it, and it's really great.
We are back in your basement.
Yes.
Here.
It's cozy. We're at maximum capacity. The studio show for the Copa America, by the way, is absolutely off the hook. Did you see that?
I just did.
That's just like the ESPN studio show.
I did just catch a glimpse of that. Yeah. Things are different down there in Brazil.
It's different. Yeah.
So on. Yeah. Anyway. But that's not why you called. So let's move on here. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we have a patron episode with Mike Wagner. Welcome, Mike.
Hello, gentlemen.
Mike, hey, down there in Texas. And then also Nick Scalera is hanging out with us again today.
Hello, everyone.
Yeah.
Hello, hello.
And
I also noticed that a few of my Flying Nun classic releases are missing from my library. I have like an alarm system.
I do have a bag that I bring in here.
They just flew away. All right. Okay, so with the Patreon episodes... the listener gets to pick the topic, as we just established. And Mike, what did you want to talk about today?
Today we're going to talk about Marvin Gaye's landmark album, What's Going On. It's the 50th anniversary of that album. It was released in May of 1971. And less importantly, it was voted the number one album in last year's Rolling Stone album ranking. And I know that's not, you know, the criteria for everything, but I found it interesting, and I love that album, and I thought it would make a great topic for today.
I think that is a great idea.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, it just got that, you know, that honor, which I thought was actually really, really great.
Yeah.
That they picked that as number one.
Yeah.
And then also, the anniversary, and then I think also just the times. You know, 2020 felt like a year to listen to this record, I think. So, all right, so tell us about your connection with it, Mike.
I don't remember when I really came to, or it became like one of my favorite albums of all time, but it's one of those that kind of crept into my consciousness over time. And now it's something that I listen to constantly. One of the reasons is that it's a fairly short album, and it's a great piece of music to listen to, a great album to listen to from beginning to end. And that's kind of one of the things I wanted to bring to listeners' attention. It's like there's some hits on there, yes, but it's a really moving album. And I think this is why it was voted the greatest album. It's, you can put it on at the beginning and it goes, and you can just listen to it all the way through. And it's really a fantastic listen all the way through.
Okay, so where do we start with this?
What I thought we'd do is start with a little background on the album, where the album came from, where Marvin was at the time it was being recorded, and then I thought we could just share our thoughts on the album. I'm sure it's an album that all you guys have listened to, and so I'll just give a little background on it to start with. As I said, it came out 50 years ago, and the album started or originated with one of the members of the Four Tops named Obie Benson, and he had witnessed a police brutality and violence committed against anti-war protesters at that time. And he discussed this with a writer named Al Cleveland, and they wrote the initial version of What's Going On. And then they sort of shopped it around, or not shop, but, you know, they sort of presented it to their friends, and eventually it came to Marvin Gaye. They brought it to Marvin Gaye, and he added his own melodies and added his own touches to it, vocals, lyrics, and he became a co-writer of the song. They took the song to Berry Gordy, of Motown, because Marvin was on Motown. And based upon what you read and what you believe and who says what, Barry, Gordy, and Motown were not that enthralled with the song. And I think one of the reasons that it was that way is if you kind of look at it, to try to understand their position, is that Marvin had been with Motown since the early 60s. And he was sort of this really sharply dressed, very clean, very, you know, because Motown had an image, right? And they always presented their stars just so. Think of the Supremes was one of them, right? They had an image with those dresses, and Marvin had his image. And Marvin was like, you know, a hit machine, right? Let's go through some of his songs. Like, it's amazing when you go through this list of songs. How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, I'll Be Doggone, It Takes Two, Your Precious Love, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, You're All I Need to Get By. And then, of course, he hit number one with that massive hit, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. So my favorite of that era, and I think what should be pointed out, is he did a lot of duets with Tammy Terrell. And the one that I personally love from that era, which I think is his high water mark, was You're All I Need to Get By. And if you listen to the ending where they're really going for it. Come on, darling, and inspire you a little higher. I know you can make the man out of the soul that didn't have a goal. Cause we got the right foundation, and we're in love and determination. You're all I want to stop for, doing it for you. All the joy under the sun, not up in the wonder.
I think this is important background, right? Because Marvin Gaye to me almost had kind of like two distinct careers, and
yes,
I do think
I agree with that. Yeah,
yeah, and both like really great.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's really quite an amazing thing. But if you go back and listen to the earlier Motown stuff he did in the '60s, I mean, he was one of the great soul singers of that era.
Oh yeah.
And then later, as we're going to discuss, kind of just completely changed his whole style. And I think to everyone's surprise, it totally worked as well. Temptations did that to some extent too, or actually to a pretty large extent as well. But Marvin Gaye kind of, you know, really impressed me with how he became sort of an artiste later in his career when you don't expect it, right?
Absolutely. I agree.
I mean, Marvin, the range that he had, I mean, I hate to say this. I read this on Wikipedia. He had a 4-octave range in his voice. That sounds really impressive. I'm not a musicologist, but you hear that. I mean, he sounds completely different to Jim's point in some of those early, what he brings out in What's Going On, not only is a completely different way of presenting music and sort of dealing with the world, but just the way it sounds, the way he sings it, the differences in his voice. It is almost like a different person, you know, and I think it's phenomenal. And one other thing I want to bring up is that we kind of forget that, like, and I have to bring this up for my D.C. folks over here. You know, Marvin Gaye was born in D.C.
Yeah.
He lived in D.C.
Right,
until
was.
The
yep.
late 50s. He started his musical career, you know, he grew up in Southwest Washington, which these days is all developed, but it sure as heck wasn't back then. It was a rough childhood he had in his home. You know, music was a way out, and he was making music in DC before he'd be so associated with Motown. I think people forget that. And I just wanted to just sort of bring that point up, but he's a fascinating character. Mm-hmm. And this sort of mid-career change he made is really rare. And it's, you know, it's not easy to do that. It's not easy to break out of that mold, especially when the Motown hit machine, it was a machine. You know, when you had everything You know, Berry Gordy was there with the songs and with the you know the backing band, and it was a formula, and it's tough to break out of that formula, and it was, you know, it took a huge effort for him to get there.
And he was a drummer too, right?
Yeah.
True. Yes.
Yes.
He was a session drummer.
Yeah.
You know, that's where Anderson Paak got all his moves. Yeah.
That's right. Right.
He records the single "What's Going On,"
mm-hmm.
and there's this great story when he's recording it. The story goes that the saxophonist, his name is Eli Fontaine. He was just sort of warming up and playing with what was being played at the backing track, and he was just improvising, and he did that opening, and Marvin goes, "Okay, that's it, you're done. That's it." And he's like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "That was it. That was perfect." He goes, "Well, I was just goofing around." And the quote is, Marvin goes, "You goof off exquisitely. Thank you." That was brilliant. I love that story.
Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up? This is a groovy party, man. Yeah, brother, I can dig it. Solid. Right on. What's up?
Hey, man, what's your name? It's everything. Get down and dig. Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, sister. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
So Marvin went, as Jim had mentioned, right? Marvin went from this clean cut, you know, Motown presented. And then he trades that in for, you know, his wool cap that he became famous for. He grew a beard and he dressed more sort of 70s urban. The other thing to remember is during this time, at the end of the 60s, Marvin was having a very difficult time. One of the things that I think really affected him is in October of 1967, Tammy Terrell, who we previously discussed, collapsed in Marvin Gaye's arms during one of those performances. And was later diagnosed with a brain tumor. She subsequently passed away just a couple of months before Marvin started recording the track, What's Going On, the single. And one thing I was thinking about when I was preparing for this is, like, they had this great, you know, duet style. And if you listen to What's Going On, it's got that single. It's got that great sort of double lead vocal thing that he did. Now, how he came up with that, there's different stories. Like, one guy said they had two takes, then he just put them together accidentally and he kind of went with it. I don't know what's true, but it sounds great. Additionally, his marriage to Anna Gordy, who was Berry Gordy's older sister, had failed. He had a growing dependency on cocaine. He had troubles with the IRS. Through certain finagling, that single came out in early 1971 and became a hit. It went all the way to number two. Based upon that, Berry Gordy said, "You can make the album however you want to now, but you have to do it by the end of March." And so it basically gave him 10 days in the studio, and they recorded the rest of the album in 10 days. Which is just staggering. And Jimmy, I know you did that previous episode on Hitsville. They recorded most of it in Hitsville. Mm-hmm. And that room is so tiny. You know, when you're in that room, you're just like, oh my gosh, like, how did they record everything in this little tiny room? And it's just like this little control area. It's like amazing.
Yes.
So again, the way I think of it is it took him 10 days, but it really took him a whole lifetime to get there. And then those 10 days, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so, so that's how the album got made. The album came out and the rest is history.
And that is, Mike, thank you so much, man. That is such good setup. And I'll tell you what it reminds me of in a similar way. And I hope I can express what I'm trying to say here. Van Morrison's Astral Weeks kind of marked a demarcation line between when he did pop music with them and, you know, Brown Eyed Girl, right, Nick, and all that stuff. And then suddenly he exploded into this song cycle type of thing. But he also was going through a similar thing. And I didn't know some of that stuff that Mike was saying. And that's amazing. Like depression and anxiety and loss of, and Morrison was going through that. Burt Burns had died and he was suddenly living from Ireland and New York and all that. And he suddenly, you know, went from Brown Eyed Girl to Astral Weeks. And it seems to me similar right here. Marvin Gaye just said, I'm going to, you know, I've been scraped raw, man. I'm just going to try to express myself, you know, the way I see the world and the way I see myself, and just came up with this masterpiece. And I'll never forget the first time I saw the album cover of What's Going On. Like, here's a dude in the rain, you know? It's like, what's going on with that? And, like, why would he be, you know, just like, he's not trying to make himself look, you know, handsome. Or, right. And there was that weird gothic script and all that. And it's like some guy just saying, I'm at the bottom and I'm going to defend myself and just be who I am from now on. Forget the record company. Forget anyone who wants me to be somebody else. I'm going to do my own thing. And if they don't like it, you know, whatever.
Oh, and I was just going to mention one of the things that, you know, we talk about the internet culture and meme culture. One of the things that really affects me about What's Going On is someone on the internet took the album cover of What's Going On and made it into an animated GIF with the rain falling down. And it's so impactful. Like watching imagining the actual rain hitting Marvin as he's standing there and the look that he sort of looks off into the universe. I mean, that's sort of an interesting sort of, but whoever did that, thank you for that. It sort of pulls in that sort of 3D aspect to what's going on, but it's why it's such a perfect album cover. Cause it provides the atmosphere for what you're going to get in this album, right?
I'd never seen an album cover where rain was deliberately included. Right. Like, that's part of your life, of course. You know, it just blew me away. Yeah,
I think too. I mean, the album speaks to the times, right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely,
you know, I think it's part an artist who feels like he has a lot more to say than he was, you know, able to before, but also the times inspiring him to say it.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, right? That's a great point. Yeah, yeah. Working together to get both of those effects. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good point, Jim, because I know Mike has been watching, and I think a lot of us have been watching this documentary about 1971 that's on Apple Plus.
Right.
And I feel like this is not a 1969 album. This is a 71 album. Yeah. Like, things had gotten so bad by 71.
Well,
there was still some optimism in 69, the Woodstock generation, but by 71 there was this sort of sense that, like, everything has just gone to hell.
Yep.
You know, peace and love didn't work. What are we going to do now? And I think Marvin is really sort of speaking to that. Actually, this album just feels so embedded in that year to me, you know, in a way that I just don't think it could have come a couple of years earlier.
Well said.
Right. Totally agree.
And another important, to speak of the album cover, if you notice, it's what's going on is not a question. It's
that's
a statement.
Right.
Statement. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Great
exactly.
point.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's really, really important because people go like, what's going
Absolutely.
On? You know, that's something we kind of say when you meet somebody, what's going on? It's a question. It's like, no. This is not a question.
No.
I think this album was a statement. One thing I wanted to note about the album, like for, and like I was mentioned earlier, I think people would really enjoy putting the album on, listening to it all the way through, is that when you do that, you notice like there's this just, there's so many instruments that kind of come in and out of the album, and he does, and he just mixes mm-hmm. everything so well. I mean, there's strings, there's percussion, and Jim mentioned earlier that Marvin indeed was a drummer. And I think one of the things that really works on this album is all the percussion. Is the just fantastic all the way through. Like when you really, really listen, the percussion is just fantastic. There's woodwinds, there's piano, there's flutes. There's a whole section where there's like, I guess it's a flute. I'm not, somebody can correct me, but there's a whole passage where there's like this flute thing playing. You know, there's saxophones, there's brass. And he just, and I think what makes, what I mean, there's albums that use these things, and what the difference between this album and other artist albums is that these all weave in and out absolutely effortlessly. And I think mm-hmm. that's the key between people who use, have lots of sound going on, and an artist like using it as a palette to paint this incredible picture on. The other thing I was thinking as I was listening to the album this week, preparing for this, I have always have this feeling when I'm listening to it, like I'm kind of like floating along on a ride, you know, because it's like there are distinct songs. What's Going On is a distinct song. We all know that mm-hmm. song, you know, Mercy, Mercy Me, distinct mm-hmm. song. But there's a lot of the songs and they cut right into each other.
Yes.
You know, it's like. It's a hard cut, but it doesn't feel like a hard cut, which I always just find amazing. And there's like within some of these longer songs, there's like movements within the song, and then it'll refer back to another movement. And mm-hmm. it's just really fantastic. And I thought of it, and it's like, and the songs will go from like one scene to another, right? I mean, so like right after the opening track is What's Happening, Brother, right? Which is literally about his brother who went to Vietnam. And then it's like there's the song Flying High, which is clearly about drugs. There's lots of religious and spiritual references. There's things about Save the Children, you know, this whole... it's like you go on these amusement rides and they kind of like fly you through or whatever. And you're like, go to this scene and then you go to this scene and you go to this scene.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's what it seemed like to me, right? You're just like, you're like... He's taking you from scene to scene, and he's changing the music, and he's making it all just work effortlessly. And you're just sort of immersed in this whole yeah. ride. That's how I think of it.
That's a really good analogy. I like that. You know, it's funny too, because I think talking about how it was just named the, you know, greatest album of all time in Rolling Stone. Well, for a long time, when Rolling Stone would do those lists and update them, the number one was always Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right? And similar in that regard, in that it's symphonic, in that it's put together as a, you know, some sort of concept or, you know, a singular kind of listening experience. But I think Sgt. Pepper's has more of the separation that you're describing, the individual songs. You know, with a couple of exceptions, than this does. This flows, I think, much more cleanly and more naturally, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, organically, yes. Totally, Jim. And Mike, one question I have to ask you, too, hearing your passion about this record and the way it flows, how do you feel about someone approaching the album today? When they get, you know, look it up on Spotify, there's... 3 discs of bonus tracks, right? Or you go to buy it, right? And it's the deluxe What's Going On edition with historical notes by that guy from Detroit. Or like, I mean, how do you feel about that? You know, especially with the original album cover.
I always, like, whatever album it is, if I'm really into it, I enjoy giving those a listen. But I don't know about most people, but I always find going back and taking the album as it was.
Amen.
You know, that's me. I love the historical aspect of it. I mean, personally, I love to see how they got there. And, you know, and I listened to, like, the bonus of all this has, you know, it has, you know, takes, early takes. I find that stuff fascinating and a really good listen, but it's not something you go back to all the time, right?
Right.
It's always fun to like to listen to a great song and then go back to listen to the takes to how they got there.
Right. Especially for an album like this, right? Yeah, especially for a landmark.
Yeah, so sorry, Patrick, but it's not something you do all the time. Like when you do it once, you're like, okay, I'm good.
Right.
Because there's a lot of work that goes into sequencing an album and
picking the
take. There's that famous saying, it's easy to add, it's hard to edit, you know?
Right.
And I think the great ones know how to edit and not just throw everything out there. It's easy to throw everything out there. It's hard to go, that's not so good, that needs to go. This 4-minute song really should be 250. Those are big things that make the big, you know, and big difference in music. And I think it's really hard for a lot of people to learn.
The only other thing I want to say is that it includes the Detroit Lions.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
And I don't know why I just love that so much.
Yeah.
But I really do. Part of it is just, I think it's just sort of kind of the novelty of it, or the idea that like Detroit is such a connected community that like, you know, here's this guy from DC who's been recording in Detroit for, you know, 10 years at that point.
Tell the story, Jim. Tell the story.
You'd invite the Lions in, but
I don't know if everybody knows the story, what you're talking about. So go ahead and tell
that story. They do some it's like the chatter kind of stuff, right?
The party.
At the beginning of what's going on, when you hear the, hey, brother, what's happening? You know, and all that stuff.
That's so they're hanging the Detroit in the Lions. Studio, right?
Yeah, they're just hanging out.
But to me, it also is just, it gives the record, I think, a sense of place in some way.
Yeah.
Getting back to what Jim was saying about the concept album, like, this to me is the king of concept albums. Like, Sgt. Pepper's is a neat trick, and Pet Sounds is sort of an atmospheric thing. But, you know, if you're going to make a concept album, make it about social justice. I mean, make it about, like, what is actually happening in the world. And no one before or since has pulled it off the way Marvin did. Maybe Stevie did a little bit with some of his work later, and obviously that was inspired by what you know, and Marvin Gaye sort of broke out of the Motown mold, and that really sort of empowered Stevie to sort of have his voice as well. But it's worth noting to people who haven't experienced it. It can be gutting. It's sad. Yeah. It's depressing in parts of it, and you feel a lot. When you listen, you will feel a lot of emotions as you go through this. And the way Marvin, you know, everything is, you mentioned the percussion and the glockenspiel and bells, and everything is intended to bring out an emotion and to sort of convey the meaning of those songs. And it's deserved number one. Like, I just can't think of anything else that should be number one. I don't think we'll see any it's like again. And honestly, I don't, you know, Marvin, he also never did he scale those heights again. I mean, you know, we have, you know, his, you know, what happens after it is a completely different album, right? You know, you go from What's Going On to like, Let's Get It On. That was also a concept album, but it was a different sort of thing.
And, hey, I like that Midnight Love.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's singular. You really need, you know, just again, last statement, you need to listen to all 30, 37, 38, 39 minutes and get that experience.
Well, one thing I think, too, is very, very interesting about this, and I love that you mentioned Stevie Wonder, because not only did Berry Gordy found Motown as a production line, Detroit Ford based system, like we can make each part great and produce a great thing at the end, yet he let his best artists have the freedom to go out and do whatever they wanted to do. In one case, gave him his own label, right? You know, and in others just said, hey, I'm not going to edit this. If you think this is finished, we'll put it out.
So. But I think it was a bit of a struggle for Barry to give them
absolutely,
that kind of freedom,
but
right?
I think that gives him huge credit as an American entrepreneur and businessman to understand that the people who are actually doing it knew more than he did, which is not the way most American corporations run.
But I also think this is interesting because I do think that this album is a statement of what, you know, not just, you know, yes, there's all the social justice, there's all of that too, but there's also a statement for sort of like what artists artist control,
yes,
right, of their
absolutely
own work, right?
Yep.
And it changed
right
in
down to the cover, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
it changed in the 70s,
yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And the 60s were, you know, a label driven, manager driven, all yep of that. And in the 70s, artists started to get more yeah control over their own work and how it was put together and how it was presented. And I think this
great
obviously
point
was a, yeah, you know, a huge, example of that. Okay. Last thoughts, Mike?
The last song I want to talk about is the final song on the album. It's called Inner City Blues. And as we were talking about how a lot of it kind of flows into it sort of segues or there's a hard cut. Before Inner City Blues, it doesn't really segue, it kind of stops. And then Inner City Blues starts with this incredible opening. It's like one of the greatest openings of all time. This is the song where he takes it from a you know, clearly a great album to arguably the greatest album of all time. And like I was saying, the opening is just stunning. And it's a masterclass of how you have this really strong opening, and then you'll hear it. It's like in comes the percussion, in comes the bass, and in comes the other stuff. And he's like mixing, you know, the sort of bells in there. And it's just brilliant. Lyrically, the lyrics are really, really, really concise, which is a little slightly different than some of the other ones. He's like, there's like just one or two word snapshots of things. And it's just, I would encourage listeners, if you're interested, like just seriously put the headphones on and just listen to this all the way through. And this song is like the payoff.
This is great, Mike. Thank you very much. This is
thank
a great
you,
conversation, and we so appreciate it. If anyone would like to comment on Marvin Gaye, what's going on, we'd love to hear it. I'm going to guess Mackenzie Crenshaw probably has something to say.
I'd love to hear
that. So I'd love to hear that. Call in
612-440-1984.
There you go. Or email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all at suburbspod. All right. Are we good? Let's get out of here.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
With us has been
Mike Wagner
and
Nick Scalera.
All right. Talk to y'all later.
Bye-bye.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be used from man? Can't you stand?
It's like when, you know, we recorded the Super Bowl Shuffle. We were all there, 85.
It's not like that at all.
Oh, never mind.